This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
In 2021, we quadrupled the size of the group from 1 to 4. Mm-hmm. And we have added one more since then through a by-election. But if we can quadruple from 4 to 16, that would be a fantastic result for us. But I'm not sure if we'll quite make that. But somewhere in that region would be great.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to this edition of Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, it was 2/3 of children in care in Medway are not actually from Medway. We hear of the curious goings-on at a Dartford corner shop and why nearly half the current batch of Conservative county councillors may be standing down. My name is Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway.
Hello.
And Daniel Essen, who covers district and borough councils across the county.
Hello there.
Later on, we'll be speaking to Rich Lehman, the leader of the Green Party at Kent County Council. Right, first up, Robert, what's been happening in Medway?
This week, I've found out that only 1/3 of children who are in care arrangements in Medway are actually the responsibility of Medway Council, the other 2/3 being from other authorities who have placed their children in the towns.
So where are these children from and why are they ending up in Medway?
So only 182 in care arrangements in Medway are actually from Medway. 398 are from elsewhere, with the majority, 171, being from London boroughs, and 119 are from areas covered by Kent County Council. 28 children are the responsibility of Surrey County Council, Thurrock Council and East Sussex County Council. Children can be placed out of their areas for safety reasons, if they're likely to be risk if they stay in their particular area. But councillors said that this is actually fairly limited in relation to the children who have been placed in Medway, and the main reason was because of the cheap accommodation which is available here.
Tell us about this cheap accommodation and what are the consequences for Medway as a council?
So councillors and officers said that the places these out-of-area children are being housed in are all within a 2-square-mile area in the most deprived area of Medway, and the accommodation really isn't actually that appropriate. They raised concerns that some streets could risk the safety of the children, and Medway Council, when it found this themselves, removed all their children from these homes. Then when KCC started to use this accommodation, Medway warned KCC and they've started to remove their children too. The problem is, it's believed these accommodations owners are contacting other further afield authorities and attracting them because this accommodation is so cheap. Medway, although not paying for the accommodation themselves, does incur costs because the children use local services, including schools, healthcare and others.
What have you been looking at then, Dan?
So I've spent some time looking at a licensing matter up in Dartford, and licensing is usually a slightly more entertaining area of council policy. This one was about a corner shop up in Dartford who ended up having their licence to sell alcohol stripped from them by the council licensing panel at the recommendation of the police.
And where were they given this sort of a punishment?
So there's several things. Most recently, the catalyst for it was an incident in May this year. Short of it is, police were called to the shop by customers who said there was a shoplifter locked into the shop, and a police call taker said that they heard member of staff beating up the shoplifter with a metal pole. The worker told his boss, and his boss then told the police that he was actually hitting him with a water pistol. And yeah, the boss told the police this at first, but police body cam footage pretty clearly shows what appears to be the handlebars of a bike or a scooter or something in the worker's hand. The police then say they hounded the shop for 2 weeks for the CCTV, and they consistently failed or refused to provide it. And when they eventually got it, 16 seconds of crucial footage was missing. And then the shop said, "We've accidentally deleted the CCTV, so we can't go back and get you the missing bit, sorry." And the police say they're pretty open, they think it was wiped intentionally. But it's more than just that. Going even further back, in January last year, the police demanded CCTV from the shop because a serious sex crime happened on a bench directly outside it. The owner of the shop told the police he could provide it for them, he could get them the CCTV easily, but the cops say he was rude and uncooperative and just refused to give it to them. And so they ended up seizing the CCTV unit under police evidentiary powers. And on top of that, the shop has also hired illegal workers on 2 separate occasions, once this year and once in 2013.
My word, it's all happening there, isn't it? So what's the deal? Surely hiring illegal workers is the sort of thing that would make you lose your licence immediately.
In theory, yeah. So the Home Office guidance for licensing purposes is that if a business is found to be hiring illegal workers, license, it's a serious crime, licence revocation should be considered as a possible sanction in the very first instance. But it's important to say, in both the illegal working matters, no further action was taken against the shop for immigration matters. But in both cases, the illegal workers were visa overstayers, people who come here legitimately on student visa or something, or have their visa revoked or its conditions changed, and they work long term in violation of that, which is pretty topical given it's not that long since a French government minister said that part of why UK has such an illegal immigration problem is because, you know, things like this make it quite easy for people to come here and work illegally. And I think this kind of thing's pretty good example.
So what's the future of the shop then?
So the subcommittee voted to strip them of their license. They were pretty scathing. You know, they said in no uncertain terms they don't trust the owners to cooperate with the police or the council when necessary. What it means is that the shop can't sell alcohol anymore. It doesn't actually mean that they've shut the business down. I'm not sure councils can do that. Only the police can shut a business down. The shop's lawyer says that booze is about 40 to 60% of their sales, and that not being able to sell it will imperil their business. Whether that will happen, we don't yet know. They could appeal against the revocation of their license, but if that's happening, I haven't heard of it, and given how the councillor spoke about them, I wouldn't rate their chances either.
So what's been happening down your way, Simon?
Well, it's getting very interesting at Kent County Council. The big test for all the big political parties come next year, the County Council elections, and Kent County Council goes to the polls as well. It's definitely a huge test for the Conservatives in Kent. They run the place and currently hold 59 of the 81 seats at KCC. But I hear there's a bit of movement.
What have you been hearing?
Well, it's my understanding that up to 27 of those 59 seats, those councillors may be standing aside at the next election for a whole variety of reasons. Some members are just getting on a bit and they're ready to hang up their boots. Some think they're likely to lose and just want to stand aside. And others have got other things to do with their lives. There may also be a bit of a weariness at the constant round of cuts at KCC, which they're having to undertake to stave off the threat of bankruptcy. But I personally have identified 22 who are likely to go, are definitely going, but the administration thinks that the actual numbers are a bit 26 or 27, but that might cool down, a bit of might go up, because obviously the nominations don't close for some months yet, but those are the people who've kind of, made their intentions clear.
So is this a problem?
Yes, potentially it is a problem for the Conservatives. The high departure rate creates an extra headache for the ruling Conservatives, as the incumbency brings a better chance of retaining a division. But the Tories will fight the election against the backdrop of getting a hammering from the Labour nationally at the election, and having had to make tens of millions of pounds worth of cuts to resident services as they struggle to avoid going bust. There'll be a lot of high-profile names going, and they've indicated that they're going to step down. People like Ros Binks, Sean Holton and Paul Cooper are three that come to mind.
And what are the big threats to the Tories?
Well, I reckon that all five Tories at Tunbridge Wells, maybe not the Cranbrook seat, which is in the same sort of geographical area, but I reckon five of the Tories at Tunbridge Wells will be targeted by the Liberal Democrats, and they're pretty confident they can win them, and not least against a backdrop of having taken control of the local council and returned a Lib Dem MP. But the great unknown is the threat posed to the Tories and Labour by Reform UK. Reform may skew results all over the place, and the main sufferers were most likely to be Labour and particularly the Tories. So it's the Liberal Democrats and the Green Party who will be hoping to be the main beneficiaries of this, and there's a strong likelihood that of a rainbow alliance emerging after May next year. The Lib Dems, the Green Party and the Labour Party all fancying their chances to be the biggest of the alliance and get to have their own leader of Kent County Council to replace Roger Gough of the Tories. But in a moment, we'll be chatting to Rich Layman, who's the leader of the Green Party at KCC, and to see what he makes of it all and see if he can shed any light on it.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Rich Layman is the leader of the Green Party group at Kent County Council, and he will be eyeing up next May's election for KCC's 81 seats with great interest. To talk about that and much more is Rich Layman, who is with us now. Welcome, Rich.
Hi, Simon.
How are you doing? You all right?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
You were born in Kent nearly 50 years ago. Just tell us a little bit about your personal background.
My background is, not really a traditional one for a county councillor or a councillor. Well, I was born in Sidcup. Grew up in Medway towns primarily, and just had a lot of jobs in finance, admin type roles, very run-of-the-mill office jobs. And thankfully in my 20s, I found a path out of that into self-employment in photography, primarily wedding photography. And I was very happily doing that until COVID came along and all my weddings were cancelled, and an opportunity came up for a career change into politics, which was not planned, although I was politically active throughout the 2010s. I'd never planned to be a councillor, but I when that opportunity came up, I took it and ran with it. Yeah. And here we are now.
Yeah. So that's your journey into politics. It's really sort of happened by accident and partly because of COVID, I guess. Why did you choose the Green Party? What attracted you to the Green Party in the first place?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's for me, there was probably never going to be any other party. From having said that, I did vote for other parties prior to 2010. But in terms of who I was always most aligned with, it was always the Green Party, right? Since I was kind of in my early teens, the climate emergency has been a big concern of mine. You know, since Sting was on TV talking about rainforests and the ozone layer and all these things that were kind of in the late 80s when I was in my early teens had a big impact on me and were a big concern for me. And it always seemed to me to be that these things weren't being given the consideration that they should have been. And as I grew older and got more involved in politics, you know, there was, as so many people do under the first-past-the-post system, you vote for the party you think has got a chance of getting in. And then in the 2010 election, I made a point then of voting for the party that I actually wanted rather than the one that I thought could get in my constituency. And I've done so ever since and have just followed that through by joining the party in 2014 and now obviously representing them publicly in Kent and in Swale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Green Party was, you know, used to be called the Ecology Party back in the day, and had a slightly different image and was, you know, very much on the fringe of British politics. And now it elects, you know, respected MPs to Parliament. I mean, well, what's changed with the Green Party? What's driven this?
I think a large part of it is the rising awareness of the climate emergency that we've got now. We're in a position that's getting worse and worse. We've had, I mean, particularly over the last couple of years, you know, record heat levels being broken all over the world and globally. Consistently, month on month on month, new records being broken. And it's just where once we were talking about this as a kind of an abstract thing in the future, we are now in it. Unfortunately, it is still happening at a rate where many people don't really perceive how far along that path we've gone and how much we've already kind of built into what will happen over the next two or three decades in terms of continued rising temperatures, continued sea level rises and other things like that. I think another part of it, though, and this is something I should have added in my last answer, is very much about how committed the Green Party are to social justice and equality. And these are elements that, A, attracted me to the party, and I think to a large degree, there are elements which perhaps we've gained a significant amount of support in the last few years because other parties which traditionally held that position have perhaps moved away from that somewhat. And some of those voters who perhaps voted Labour in 2017 and 2019, which were, if you look at the votes across the country in general elections, you'll see that the Greens did particularly well in 2015 and then took a dip in 2017 and 19 and then jumped back up at the most recent elections. And that does tie in with the time when the Labour Party had a more socialist-leaning leader.
Do you think it's a lot of the popularity in Kent, you know, folks in and Hythe is now sort of like run by a Green Party leader, same yeah. that things happened at Maidstone Borough Council. Yeah. Do you think that's partly because of the scandal of water companies dumping raw sewage into coastal waters and rivers and the amount of house building? I mean, people are getting really fed up with it. But I personally, I know Conservative voters who have started to vote Green, you know, yeah. and when, you know, they are completely, almost diametrically opposed in terms of the wings of British politics.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say they're diametrically opposed, but certainly on more on the economic side, they're at quite different places. And, you know, the KCC division that I was elected to in 2021 was one that had been held by the Conservatives for at least 50 years. And the only one in Swale, which had been consistently conservative over that time period. And a lot of people voted for me for a number of reasons, including the ones that you've mentioned, like housing. I mean, perhaps not so much on the water quality, but that is certainly an issue which the Green Party gets a lot of traction on because we're quite unequivocal in our criticism of the water companies and the current setup that we've got. And there's also the fact that locally, when I was campaigning in 2021, I would meet people on the doorstep who were very happy to vote for me as a Green councillor to represent them at the county council, but were then quite open in saying that they wouldn't vote Green at a general election. And those people, you know, are cognizant of the differences in now two groups, two parties in terms of economic policy, and they're quite happy to vote Green for a Green representative to represent them locally, because they know that that area of Green policy is not something that will really hugely come into play. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it will in certain areas of council work, but not in the same way that it would in government. And I see our role as being one of building that trust. You know, the Green Party are, as far as I'm aware, still the most trusted brand in terms of the main political parties in the UK.
Kent County Council elections come up next May. It's difficult to see, really, who of the opposition parties is likely to come out top for various different reasons. But, you know, how do you think it will pan out for the Greens, and what specific sort of areas in Kent do you think you'll be targeting in terms of the best chance of returning the most number of councillors you can?
Really, we're looking at winning or taking at least, you know, one or two seats in most districts in Kent. And as I imagine you would expect, we're perhaps looking at taking the greater numbers in the districts in which we have stronger district council representation. And overall across the county, I think we're looking at, in 2021, we quadrupled the size of the group from 1 to 4. Mm-hmm. And we have added one more since then through a by-election. But if we can quadruple from 4 to 16, that would be a fantastic result for us. But I'm not sure if we'll quite make that, but somewhere in that region would be great.
So you're not sure you'll get up to 16? But that region...
Well, we'll see. Mm. I mean, we might get up to 20. But
yeah, sure.
We'll see.
What sort of areas do you think that you will be particularly strong in? I mentioned Maidstone, folks, and Hythe and Ashford are three. But I mean, where else would you be targeting, knowing that you've got a good apparatus there, got a good database, you know where your supporters live? I mean, where apart from that do you think there might be some traction for you?
Well, like I said, it's most of the county. We'll be looking at seats in pretty much every district. Swale, obviously, is where I'm based, so we're going to be defending my seat, and maybe one other, but Thanet, Canterbury, Dover, Sevenoaks.
Do you see yourself doing any deals? You know, albeit tacit deals. You know, in certain places, you know, we'll let you in, and you know, if it's a way of keeping the Tories out or whoever. Do you see anything like that going on?
I certainly haven't had any conversations as yet. I'm not entirely opposed to the idea, but at the same time, I'm reluctant to do too much in the way of deals. And I think it will be a case of waiting until nearer the time to have those conversations to see what is necessary in the way of deals. It's not really any kind of trade secret, given the current makeup of the county council, to assume that Labour, the Liberal Democrats and ourselves will be going after primarily Conservative seats should Reform make good on their recent claims that they will be campaigning to become a force on Kent County Council. They will be significantly denting the Conservative Party vote in a lot of areas, and that could potentially open the door to a lot of the more progressive parties taking seats without having to make deals. But like I say, that's possibly a conversation to be had nearer the time.
Yeah, there has been some talk of a rainbow alliance. You know, obviously it would be the red, green and yellow type. But there are some reservations between each of those parties. I mean, does the Green Party have reservations with either of them? And if so, what would they be?
I mean, in terms of the current Labour group at KCC, I get on very well with them, as I do with the Lib Dems as well. And so I've got no reservations of working with those councillors as people. Obviously, we're in a slightly different position now than we've been for most of the time I've been a councillor, in that the Labour Party are obviously in government now rather than in opposition. And whilst we've been in a somewhat easier position politically in terms of arguments to be made in the council chamber in terms of the Conservative Party's failure to fund local government effectively, that would be difficult now going forwards if Labour carried on with funding levels that we've seen under the last 14 years. Well, I mean, even if they didn't bring them back up again, if they kept them flat rather than continuing to cut, that would be something that would be, obviously, it would make the future of Kent County Council financially questionable in itself. But in terms of working together in alliance with the Labour Party in particular, that would be tough. Having said that, I think we're so aligned in terms of what we would want to do with the council that should the opportunity arise to create that coalition, I think there would need to be some very strong arguments against doing that for us to consider them. And I mean, and again, it'll all come down to the numbers at the end of the day as to whether that's even a prospect or not.
Okay, now, leaving aside who might actually become the biggest, you know, individual party in that sort of rainbow coalition, should it run the administration, you're going to inherit one hell of a difficult situation. You know, how would you be able to fix what the Tories haven't been able to fix, given the funding levels being what they are? Where would you find the savings? Where would you go? What would you do to fix the problem?
I think that would be very difficult. I mean, we, as kind of I just alluded to in my previous answer, we agree with a lot of the Labour Group's solutions in terms of looking to bring things in-house, particularly around adult social care. This is an area which, we have these huge contracts with companies that make huge profits, and where possible, there are savings to be made through bringing things in-house. But then that very act of bringing things in-house comes with large one-off costs to do that, to make that change. So I would really need to get into the numbers a lot more on that. There are certain things as well to do with homeschool transport. And then there was a budget proposal that I brought forward last year in terms of looking at different ways to fund some of the, or, you know, create a different method of employment for some of the homeschool transport to reduce that current bill, which I think is somewhere around 60, 70 million.
Going up to 80, apparently.
Yeah, if we can look at some radical new ways of doing things like that. I'm not saying that we can cut that right down, but if there's, you know, even a £5-10 million saving to be had there, then that would help a great deal.
Can you put your finger on why central government does not appear to be listening to the pleas of local government about funding?
I'm afraid I can't. I honestly don't know how much they genuinely are. I mean, I wouldn't say they're ignoring them. That would just be daft. But it certainly is very difficult to understand why when there's the huge weight of evidence is there that councils are having to make the levels of cuts that they're making, why there hasn't been any kind of a change in direction yet. But maybe that will happen, and maybe we'll see that in an autumn budget from Labour.
Okay. If devolution of some sort is the answer, why is no one talking about it and not doing anything to make it happen?
I think there are talks about it. There have been some kind of rumblings in the last few months. With Angela Rayner sent out a letter to local councils with a office and kind of a fake.
Well, there wasn't much detail in it, was there? I mean, that's what I'm saying.
No, that's not what I was really talking about, are they? That's right. But I mean, those conversations are ongoing. Whether the information that came out from the new government was detailed or not, the conversations are happening. And my understanding currently is that unitarisation, because the cuts have got so bad and because the cost pressures are so great, unitarisation is not seen as the panacea, the magic bullet that it once was in terms of cost savings. So there's perhaps less of a desire to go down that route. And as per another motion which we took to KCC full council a couple of years ago, the Green Group and the Lib Dems were in agreement with this, that we would prefer to see, if possible, some kind of Kent Assembly along a similar lines to the Northern Ireland Assembly as a kind of a governance model for Kent, given that our population is virtually the same as the population of Northern Ireland, and given our unique position within the country as the gateway to Europe. But I don't know how much appetite there is for that from the other political parties. But I think the one thing all groups at KCC are aligned on is the opposition to a directly elected mayor.
Well, the thing is about Northern Ireland is that you do have an assembly, but that was sort of partly set up to try and keep the peace. And there's still local councils all over the place, you know, so it's not as if you're cutting out, you know, by having that kind of authority, you're not really kind of cutting out the layers of bureaucracy and you know, local government that perhaps you would need to say if you had three unitary authorities and disappear and see all the councils disappear.
My understanding is that an assembly model could come with greater funding from government and the freedom to spend that money as we wish. I would like to see district and borough councils remaining places they are, because from my point of view and the Green Party position is that power should be handed down. And what we've got at the moment is this odd situation of devolution. But when it involves a directly elected mayor, that feels like power being handed up rather than down. Mm-hmm. And the Green Party policy is that decisions should be made on whichever level, as local a level as possible, to be convenient and efficient.
Yeah. Okay. Finally, what are your own personal longer term political ambitions? Fancy seat in the House of Parliament?
Possibly. To be honest, my thoughts on that kind of change week by week. Sometimes I'm thinking end of the 2020s will be enough for me, but sometimes I'm thinking maybe longer term and doing this as a role for the rest of my life. And part of that would be standing for Parliament, obviously. But yeah, it will be a case of let's wait and see what happens the next time the general election comes around.
Okay, Rich Layman, thank you so much for your time today, and I hope we speak again soon. Good luck.
Thank you.
Just picking up on an earlier thread, Reform UK may have a significant role in deciding the fate of many seats coming up at Kent County Council next year, and had a major impact on the fates of Conservative MPs. I just wonder if there's any mileage in those defeated MPs sticking around for a while, you know, upping their profile, perhaps becoming local councillors. What do you think?
I think there's definitely evidence to support that sort of idea. I mean, here locally in Medway, Kelly Tolhurst and Raymond Chishti, who were both defeated at the general election, largely because of huge swing with Reform UK taking up a large amount of the vote share. They both are still sort of active. They're posting on Twitter. They're going to events. Kelly Tolhurst was actually incorrectly listed as the MP for Rochester and Strood in a Conservative Party document the other week, but that was quickly amended. But they are still around. They are still doing things. They are still active. And I think definitely there is a question that possibly they're banking on that the Reform flame might sputter out, you know, over the next 5 years, and that will basically put greater pressure on Labour, which, you know, particularly in Rochester and Strood, I think the majority that Lauren Edwards, the Labour now MP, won was less than 3,000, definitely. I think it was around 2,200. If Reform does recede, then they can just step back into their old roles, maybe what they're hoping for.
Well, there is, I've heard from some Conservatives that they can't rely on that, that the Reform maybe sort of squabbling amongst themselves or sputtering out, as you put it. But if you look at Dartford, a majority of 355, doesn't get slimmer than that. Ashford, around 1,800, Folkestone in the High, 3,700, Gravesham, 2,700, and Dartford just under 1,200. So, and I've heard that in Gravesham, there are people within the Conservative ranks who are trying to persuade Adam Holloway, who's a defeated Conservative MP there, to maybe stand as a Kent County Councillor just to keep his profile up. He's thinking about it. He says he's thinking about it. So that'll be an interesting thing to follow. Maybe Ashford, maybe Damon Green's probably a bit dull in the tooth now to be thinking about sort of like trying to relaunch his career sort of at a local level. But you know, the younger parliamentarians who have left, like Damien Collins at Folkestone and Hythe, majority of 3,700 today. But I mean, you know, if he's going to stick around in the area and he's going to hold a, you know, maybe work from the constituency, he might, you know, think about dabbling his hand in some local issues. Maybe not elected to the local council.
I think it'd be difficult for a lot of former MPs to adjust to being members of local councils, though, because at once it involves probably a lot more. The minimum standard work you have to do is probably a lot more. You don't have to go to London for it, but you are, if you're in administration, you are actually directly responsible for service delivery in a way which MPs aren't. I mean, also it's much less glamorous and doesn't go over as well on Twitter as parliamentary antics do. So I think it'd be a hard ask to convince a lot of politicians to go from being members of Parliament, where they can at least feel like they're doing something, to being a local councillor.
Yeah, I get that. You know, well, at Kent County Council, we've got Anthony Hook, Liberal Democrat. He was an MEP. I mean, so he's quite...
Yeah, the MEP, yeah, well, the European Parliament, where lots of real political work goes on, it's not, you know, it's maybe fair enough to compare it to a local council, but it's not exactly the actual House of Commons.
No, it's not. I get what you're saying, but I mean, the fact of the matter is that the Conservative Party probably haven't quite worked out what it wants to do yet. Certainly hasn't got a new leader. So perhaps those people, if they were thinking of sort of keeping their hand in, are maybe doing so just until the point at which they know what the new leader wants. So what of the crop of parliamentarians that we've lost? People like guy had done Tunbridge Wells.
Greg Clark, former MP for Tunbridge Wells, not exactly an anonymous figure. I believe he was quite responsible for writing the National Planning Policy Framework in the early 2010s. And I think he had maybe some positions as a trade envoy at some point. But he, since losing to Liberal Democrats Mike Martin, he's now working for either University of Warwick or some business development board on regeneration of Warwick. So he's actually gone into regular private sector work, whereas a lot of other former MPs seem to think tweeting passes for still being involved in politics.
Okay. Yeah, I see where you're going with that, Dan. People like, Greg Clark, you've been a cabinet member, quite, high up in government. Clearly, very, very clever bloke. He's always going to get poached by somebody. But there will be others, maybe, who don't have a great track record in other things before they went into power. But a lot of them were spads and worked within the machinery. So it might be difficult to see how they're going to find another job unless it's in the charity sector or, as some sort of consultant to in business of some kind.
I think, definitely on election night when it's... Speaking of sort of Kelly Cohen, she said basically somebody asked the question of what are you going to do next? And she basically said, well, I'm from Rochester, so that's where my home is. I'm going to stick around. She didn't say, I'm definitely going to be the candidate the next time around, though, you could definitely read that into it. But, I think a lot of MPs, particularly in Kent, I think a fair few of them are local people. They are invested in their area. So for them to say, well, it was close, I'll stick around a bit longer and see, if next time around I lose again, then maybe I won't.
Particularly if you have that Reform UK threat taken away, because all those seats that we've been talking about, you take Reform out, the Tories would have won easily. Mm. I mean, really quite easily. They may not have had the 20,000 majorities they had before, but certainly they would have been, they would have been a comfortable majority that, probably would have meant they weren't even marginals.
Mm. Well, I suppose that brings us on to sort of the bigger, more difficult thing for Conservative MPs or former Conservative MPs to reckon with is what happens with Reform UK? Which direction do they go? Do they grow from here? Now Nigel Farage and the four others are in the House of Commons and can speak in that sort of platform rather than from the outside. Does that help them or does that hinder them? I mean, what do you think?
Well, I think it's very important to think about how they decide to what way they want to shift. Do they want to take Reform head on? Or do they want to just let the right of the party sort of live on the right of the party and choose somebody that's going to have more mainstream appeal? At the end of the day, they're not picking a leader for the members. They're picking a leader for the wider the public. Yeah. The problem is, I think as Michael Howard said the other week on this podcast, he said that for the next couple of years, nobody's going to be listening to them anyway. Your policies, until you get some policies and you can actually sort of get the policies across, it's almost like point of saying anything at all. You've got to pipe up and just go through the motions. And it very much feels like that at the moment because they don't have a new leader. They don't really have anybody sort of in the big shadow posts with any authority at the minute. So we'll have to see what happens as time goes on.
I think that maybe gives Reform more of an opportunity on the national scale, at least, though, because nobody's going to be interested in what the Conservatives have to say.
Yeah.
And some would say if they pick a the kind of leader who would appeal more to the parliamentary party, somebody more of the centre, not usually the type who grab headlines or enthuse the public, whereas obviously Nigel Farage, probably the most personally popular politician in the UK. The party doesn't have existing party political infrastructure in the way that the Labour Party or any other one in the country does. But if for the next couple of years nobody's listening to the Conservatives, but the government seem to be underperforming on important issues like immigration, it gives quite a massive opening for one of the only politicians in the country who can credibly claim to have personal profile, i.e. Reform's leader Nigel Farage, to make quite a lot of hay out of it. The question is, they've committed to democratising and establishing an actual proper party, whereas at the moment it's just a private company. The question is, will they do that, and will forming an actual party rather than basically a private company with him as the chairman make it easier or harder for them to be a real political force? But when so few people are members of political parties these days, it'll be an interesting experiment to see.
What they will say is they completely revolutionised the way politics is done in this country. We know in Kent that they don't even have an office, much less any kind of sort of admin structure or local associations or anything like that. They're just basically going to fight the next election very much on a flag, a slogan, and maybe some visits from Nigel Farage. So we'll be able to see what will happen next year when it happens. Okay, folks, that's your lot this week. Thanks to Rob and Dan and our special guest, Rich Lehman. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics news from across the county. All the best.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.